Bullseye with Jesse Thorne is a production of MaximumFun.org and is distributed by NPR.
I'm Jesse Thorne. It's Bullseye. My guest is Lisa Hanawalt. She's a cartoonist, a writer, and now she is the creator of the new show, Tuca and Birdie. It's an animated series on Netflix, and it is so great. I love Tuca and Birdie. It's a show about two women, two anthropomorphic bird women. They live in Birdtown. Tuca is a toucan. She's outgoing and fun. She's also kind of a mess. She doesn't really have a solid job. Birdie, her best buddy, is a songbird, kind of a homebody, a little shy and deferential. And when the show starts, she's just moved in with her boyfriend. A lot of the problems Tuca and Birdie encounter are fairly human and grounded. Relationship stuff, work stuff, sexual harassment. But the world that they live in is anything but grounded. It is breathtakingly vivid, extraordinarily surreal. Phones talk, hospital equipment talks, plants walk around. If you've seen Lisa's work before, she's written 4 books of comics and was also a producer on BoJack Horseman and designed the look of that show. It'll give you some sense of what Tuca and Birdie is like. In fact, Lisa based Tuca and Birdie on characters from her books, characters she's lived with for a long time and sees as sort of extensions of herself. Anyway, let's take a listen to a little bit of the show. Like I said, Birdie has just moved in with her boyfriend, which means that Tuca, her roommate, is moving out. In this scene, Birdie, who's played by Ali Wong, calls Tuca, who's played by Tiffany Haddish, for an update.
So when do you want to come over to get your things? You're not officially moved out until you've taken out your last box of stuff.
Sure. I'll come get it later. I'm just picking out some decor for my new place.
Tuca, are you getting junk off the street again?
No, I'm purchasing consumer goods. With my job money.
You don't have a job.
Just because I don't have a boring office job like you doesn't mean I'm not swimming in gigs. Mobile notary, fortune teller, unlicensed tour guide, dog walker, cashing checks from my rich auntie, mobile notary again, and freelance junk collector. Anywho, I'm swinging by our place. I mean, your place. Later today.
Lisa, welcome back to Bullseye. I'm happy to see you.
Thank you for having me.
And congratulations on this show. I am just over the moon about how much I love it. I just think it's so great.
Thank you.
Were you scared to make a television show?
Of course I was. I'm scared of everything.
But I mean, like, I
was like, this will be a catastrophe, the biggest failure yet.
Lisa, I am such a fan of your comics, and I'm such a fan of your work on BoJack Horseman as well. It's my favorite part of a great show. And
oh, thanks.
But that said, your comics are more impressionistic than they are narrative. They're not narrative.
Yeah.
But they, you know, timelines are loose. Lists are incorporated frequently.
It's loose.
And I thought, you know, Lisa's been working on a TV show for a long time. They're also like wild. They're like wildly, there's just a lot of ideas going different places.
Yeah, it's a little untethered
and
to
I thought,
reality.
I thought, how does this become a sitcom?
Yeah.
Like, that was my thought. I was worried.
That was why it took so long to develop the show, is because I was talking with about the show ideas with Raphael, and we kind of wanted it to resemble my comic books, but it was sort of hard to make a show that did that. It was going to be kind of like a one-woman anthology, but then I just kept coming back to these characters of Tuca and Birdie, and honestly, the shows I like to watch are sitcoms, so I was just like, maybe I should learn how to make one.
What kind of sitcoms do you like to watch?
I mean, I love Friends. I've watched it so many times. It's just so comforting.
Is that just because it like relates to your adolescence when it was on television?
Perhaps. Yeah, there's a little bit of nostalgia there. I don't know. I just think the characters are really well defined, and I don't know. It's just comforting.
I hate Friends.
That's fair. That's
Thank
totally
you.
Fair.
I'm not saying it to attack you. I'm just confessing it.
I don't feel attacked.
I really like Lisa Kudrow.
She's the best one.
All of the cast members of Friends do a great job.
Lisa Kudrow is absolutely the best one. Phoebe's the best character. She deserves so much better on that show.
Did you imagine when you were a kid or a teen that Friends was what adulthood might be like?
I don't know.
Because, like, I wonder sometimes if I thought, like, Seinfeld or News Radio or the shows that I loved when I was an adolescent Cheers.
I also loved News Radio
so much. I used to watch Cheers with my dad. And, like, Cheers actually is very sad show.
Cheers is too sad for me. News Radio does feel like what adulthood is like. News Radio feels very accurate.
Just once a year you're in space for no reason.
Yes. We all have a Matthew in our lives. Yeah, very relatable.
So when you were developing the show into, you know, when you were creating your own sitcom and you started with the idea that it would be as loose as your comics or at least reflect the spirit of your comics, how do you match that up with the, you know, the kind of tight strictures of what a sitcom is, which is, you know, a visit with a family who are your friends?
It's really hard. It's a process of me learning the structure of how to write a script in the sitcom style. You know, here's act one, act two, like, and then kind of doing that and then feeling like that's too tight and then loosening it back up again. So it was a whole, you know, learning experience, learning the process of writing a show. Like, I would write the scripts and then we would tell the directors, like, well, here's the script, but unlike BoJack, this doesn't need to be as strictly script-based. Like, you can take scenes out, you can add scenes, you can break up the format, you can do claymation or puppetry if you want to do that for a scene, like, have fun with it. You know, we gave them my comic books and we're like, look how crazy these are. Feel free to incorporate some of this into the episodes. And so they kind of went nuts adding stuff.
I mean, one of the things that I was struck by, and it was also one of the things that I was worried about, is I think your comics are so funny.
I'm glad you were so concerned.
Look, I hold you in very high regard, Lisa. I wanted it to be a success and it totally is.
Oh, I'm so glad.
And I thought, you know, your comics are so funny, but there are so few jokes in your comics. The things that I find myself laughing at are like audacious ideas that I connect with emotionally in some surprising way.
Yeah.
More than a gag.
I mean, I can write a joke. I feel like this weird situations and like things that kind of don't seem like they should go together and then they make you laugh and you're not quite sure where the laugh is coming from is to me my favorite form of humor. When writing the scripts, it's like the jokes are kind of the last step. You can just kind of layer jokes on top of everything else and that's the easiest part in a way.
One of the things that is in your comics that's also in the show and also was part of your design of the characters and the aesthetics of BoJack Horseman is things being kind of simultaneously uncomfortably sexual and also like anti-sexual.
Yeah, I really like that push-pull where you're like, well, this is making me horny and that makes me upset. And now I'm mad. I mean, I'm going to make you like have a crush on a plant. I'm sorry.
I mean,
I'm going to slap boobs on a building.
That's what I was about to bring up. Like,
is that sexy? I don't know.
In the montage at the beginning of the show, in the opening credit sequence, there's a building that has boobs.
Yeah.
The boobs are like doing a dance. And I mean, speaking as a heterosexual man, I'm conditioned or biologically predisposed to think of boobs sexually.
Yeah.
But
we all are.
I can't say the same about buildings.
Some people are really into buildings.
That's true.
but that was a real kind of scene setter. Like, hey, warning, there's going to be stuff like this in this show. If you don't like this, maybe don't watch it. And also, you know, like, this is for adults and we're going to recontextualize female body parts in a weird way.
It is very conscious of women's bodies in particular in a way that your comics are, but not a lot of television shows are. Was that something that you think came from a choice you made or just a natural predilection that you have?
Well, I grew up, you know, with the same media as everyone else. And so I'm used to looking at women's bodies in a certain context and in music videos and in advertisements and stuff. And so I think part of me drawing them a lot is kind of reclaiming that a little bit, like just kind of taking all that in and spitting it back out in my own way, where it's, you know, coming from the direct experience of a woman who's grown up in a world where that stuff is the norm. So it's still sometimes male gazey, but then it's also female gazey. And it's sort of like, well, here's what I like about looking at the female form. And yeah, they can be sexy. We do have like an upskirt shot, you know, while they're dancing. Like, I'm not opposed to that.
What could be sexier than that?
I like sexy stuff, but I think coming from my perspective, it's maybe a little bit different from other shows that are created by men. Like, you know, not all my characters are like big titty, tiny waist. Can I say titty on this show?
You just did. We're going to have to ask a nice man named Mark at NPR. We'll find out later.
So I mean, I like, you know, showing different kinds of body types. I think a lot of different kinds of bodies can be sexy. So I don't know. I'm just making the show I want to watch.
So when you were on the show a few years ago, we talked a little bit about your character designs for BoJack Horseman and the really strong opinions that some internet communities have shared with you about certain choices in depicting anthropomorphized animals.
Oh, are you talking about the tails?
Yes. Specifically, I'm talking about whether horsemen have tails.
Right.
I believe BoJack does not have a tail, at least a visible tail.
But there's no tails on BoJack.
But they felt very strongly and frankly rudely expressed to you that they demanded you to, I believe it was, remake the first season with tails.
Yeah, they thought we should go back and reanimate the whole thing. I think they didn't quite have an understanding of the process or budget or you know, interest in doing that, but I thought it was a very fun email to get.
I mean, Game of Thrones took out that Starbucks cup, so.
Did they?
Yeah.
They fixed it?
So you just put in the tails.
I think leave it in. Show a little of the process. I think there are some tails on Tuca and Birdie. I think there's the deli guy, the monkey man. I think he has a tail.
So what I wonder is, when you are creating anthropomorphized birds, which is the greater part of the characters on the show, because they live in a bird town.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, I believe they live in Bird Town.
It's called Bird Town.
Yeah.
It's about 7 hours away from Horseville.
Do you make choices about what things you are going to make person-like and what things you are going to make bird-like? Because birds have breasts, for example, but they don't have breasts.
Yeah. Just kind of a gut feel. Most of the characters don't have tails because they're more humanoid, but then there are some non-anthropomorphic animals. There's a bird that flies around, but it has a tail, but it also has boobs, just because that's funny to me. There's like trains that are snakes and slugs. There's just giant snakes. There's plant people. I mean, yeah, I don't know. It comes down to each individual object or character. Birdie's phone comes alive and speaks to her because it makes sense to me for it to do so.
Have you gotten feedback about the choices that you've made on the new show?
I think some people are just like, whoa, this is too weird.
It's very weird.
But most people, I think, are into it. Like, I think there's a logic to the world that makes sense once you get past how strange it is at first. It's like, yeah, the fast train is a snake and the slow train is a slug. Who doesn't understand that? It's like Richard Scarry kind of stuff, but for adults. We've all grown up like reading books with surreality and animal people and stuff, so I don't think it's that odd.
Sometimes TV shows have what's called the Bible, which is like a list of rules of the universe.
Yeah.
And, you know, that might be...
We have a Bible.
Yeah. How do you make a Bible so that your insane surreality is consistent from episode to episode?
I mean, our Bible is more about how we want it to look and like what the animation should do and like how we like it when Tuca's turned to the side and looks like a hieroglyphic. That's like the iconic Tuca pose. So we're like, let's keep her in this, you know, sideways pose as much as possible. As far as the rules of the universe, we just work it out in the writer's room for the most part. Each episode we break, we're like, well, would this happen? Does it make sense for this? Like, can an ultrasound machine come to life? And yeah, it made me laugh so hard in the room that absolutely yes. So yeah, we're kind of just building it as we go along. I don't like to define like the hard sci-fi of a world before I've written the story. I think it's kind of limiting.
Can you give me an example other than the ultrasound machine of something that you had to work out the rules of while you all were sitting there?
Very early on in the process, I remember I was talking about the universe with Raphael, who's the exec producer, and he's the creator of BoJack, and he helped me develop Tuca and Birdie. And he said, okay, so in this universe, like, is Bird Town in USA, like in the United States? And I was like, yeah, I think so. He's like, is there a China in this world? And I said, I don't know. And he said, is there Chinese food? And I said, yes. So I guess there has to be a China.
D- Did the characters come out of an idea you had about things that I would think of as word things, like personal qualities or things like that? Or did they come from things that I would think of as picture things, like big beaks and colors?
I mean, Tuca was kind of born out of me watching a nature documentary about toucans. And one of them was like stealing eggs out of other birds' nests and gobbling them up. And the other birds were building their nests longer and longer to try to avoid these long toucan beaks stealing their young. And I thought, oh, that's me, because I'm so greedy with food. That's definitely me. That's my id. So then I made up this character who could kind of like be and express like all the things that I don't because I live in polite society. So that was just fun for me.
You sort of live in polite society.
Sort of.
You skirt the edges of polite society,
getting
Lisa.
Less polite by
I've
the
read
day.
Your books, Lisa.
I do whatever I can get away with.
Yeah.
And then Birdie came out of a comic I made that was a little bit more earnest and less funny about a couple buying a house. And she was obsessed with plants and she filled the whole house with plants to kind of push him away emotionally. And it was a very personal story. So when we were developing the show, I just kind of felt like those were two characters I'd invented that I wanted to see more of. And they kind of felt like they wrote themselves to me. They were kind of like two different aspects of my own personality, but also reminded me of like friends that I have.
I want to play a clip from Tuca and Birdie. And my guest is the creator of the show, Lisa Hanawalt. And so Tuca is... So Birdie works at... Condé Nast, mm-hmm. which is a magazine publishing firm, and she's not she doesn't have a glamorous job. She's a data analyst, and she is trying to put herself in line for a promotion. She's kind of being talked over in meetings by a loud, jerky dude, and she's pretty shy, and she's not even sure that her boss notices that she does good work. And so she has this plan that she's going to convince him to notice her, then promote her by making high-quality small talk.
Hey, Holland.
Oh, good morning, Bertie.
That was some nice weather we had over the weekend, huh? It just makes you want to go to the beach.
Did you go to the beach?
Oh, no. I mean, I thought about it, but it's a long drive, and I'm afraid of crabs.
You guys talking about the beach? You gonna catch some waves out there, Holland Dog?
You know it, Dirk.
All right.
Booyah, water sports, ba-bow. Yeah, sometimes I have nightmares about that part of the ocean where the water gets super dark because it's so deep. Like, what if there's a giant monster crab down there waiting to pinch my butt?
Cartooning is a very solitary profession.
Mm-hmm.
And television is the opposite
very,
of that.
Very communal, yes.
And I wonder, you know, when you started working on BoJack and then, you know, started being in charge of a show, what it was like going from sitting at a drafting table or a computer by yourself in your house with a croissant to just like would presume what you're up to.
Always with my trusty croissant.
Look, I've seen Caroline in the City. I know a little something about this. It's what adults are like. To an office. Like, it's one weird thing about show business is how sad the offices are. Like, you're like, the acoustic tiling? Really? We're making American Gladiators or whatever.
Yeah, even ours, which is really nice, but there's no windows. So it's really, like, I get kind of sad in there. It was really hard, especially running the writer's room, because I'd only sat in the BoJack writer's room a couple of times, and it was terrifying. So to suddenly be in there and be in charge was just, it was so, I just wasn't used to, like, sitting and looking at other people for 7 hours, like, and just my neck and shoulders would hurt from just, like, nodding at people to show them that I was, like, listening to their ideas. Like, it was like I was learning how to, like, be a human, because I was used to, like, sitting alone in my office working at my desk all day. But after a couple weeks, I just got used to it. It's amazing, like, what you can adapt to.
Did you get used to being the boss and decider?
Not really, but, you know, I go at it with a very collaborative point of view. I know it's ultimately up to me, and I get to decide. And if I feel strongly about something, I can, you know, decide that, and that feels great. But I can always ask people what they think. I can let the wonderful artists and directors and editors and writers who work on my show have a say, and that feels really good because they improve things. So yeah, I'm kind of uncomfortable being called a boss.
Even more with Lisa Hannawalt to come. When we come back from a break, it's time for Horse Talk with Lisa Hannawalt. She's got a horse. It's a really cute horse. What's the horse's name? Stay tuned and find out. In the business, we call that a tease. It's Bullseye, the show, not the horse, from MaximumFun.org and NPR. Bullseye is made possible by Airbnb Experiences, who wants you to reimagine your bucket list. Whether you're home or traveling to a place you've never been, the same question always seems to come up. What should we do? It doesn't have to be that hard. Airbnb Experiences are one-of-a-kind activities hosted by passionate locals in more than 1,000 cities, all vetted for quality and created for the curious. That's you. Check out airbnb.com/experiences to learn more.
Hi, I'm Joe Firestone.
And I'm Manolo Moreno.
And we're the hosts of Dr. Game Show, which is a podcast where we play games submitted by listeners, regardless of quality or content, with in-studio guests and callers from all over the world.
And you can win a custom magnet.
A custom magnet.
Subscribe now to make sure you get our next episode.
What's an example of a game, Manolo?
Pokemon or medication.
How do you play that?
You have to guess if something's a Pokemon name or medication.
Medication.
First-time listener, if you want to listen to episode highlights and also know how to participate, follow Dr. Game Show on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter.
We'd love to hear
from you. It's really fun.
For the whole family, we'll be every other Wednesday starting March 13th, and we're coming to Max Fun!
Snorlax.
Pokemon?
Yes.
Nice.
James Reeve was fatally beaten on Selma Street in 1965. His death would galvanize the nation.
But in a courtroom 9 months later, a not guilty verdict was handed down.
In episode 2, the trial and the birth of a conspiracy theory.
From NPR, it's White Lies. Listen and subscribe now.
Welcome back to Bullseye. I'm Jesse Thorne. My guest is Lisa Hannawalt. She's a cartoonist and the author of 4 amazing books, including Hot Dog Taste Test, My Dirty Dumb Eyes, and more. She's a producer on Netflix's BoJack Horseman and has now created her own series. It's called Tuca and Birdie. It's an animated sitcom about 2 bird women who live in a city called Birdtown, and it is great. Let's get back to our interview. There are 3 leads of the show, and none of them are white, and certainly none of them are white dudes. You've got Steven Yeun.
Mm-hmm. Ali Wong.
Ali, the great Ali Wong.
Tiffany Haddish.
My bud from San Francisco, Tiffany Haddish, the legendary Tiffany Haddish. Was that a choice that you made or a matter of happenstance?
Kind of both. I wanted to make sure we didn't end up with an all-white cast because that's happened so often before in both live action and animation. And then just looking at, you know, auditions and stuff, this was just the best possible cast. There was no way around it. Like, we got Tiffany signed on very early, and then it was a matter of finding a birdie that would sound great with Tiffany. And Allie was the best. Absolutely. And they already knew each other. They had great chemistry. And then, yeah, Steven Yeun just had the best audition.
Steven Yeun's good.
He's so good. He's very, I can't believe like how quickly he can go from comedy to drama. Like I don't quite know any other actor who can do it like him.
I'm not surprised to hear that Tiffany Haddish was cast first on the show because she is such a dynamo of a performer. Like she's just such a force.
Yeah. When I saw Girls Trip, I just said, that's a Tuca. Like, it was just undeniable.
What were the qualities that you saw in her as a performer that made you think that's a Tuca?
Absolutely fearless, incredibly funny, but also like had an earnestness or vulnerability. Like, you know, like the way she like stood up for her friends in the movie, like, I don't know, she just kind of hit like every quadrant of what I wanted. And then I was reading an article and I recognized the name of her manager at the time and I knew him. So I was like, oh my God, we can get a script to her. And we did. And she said yes right away. And I cried. It was a great day.
Do you think of that character who is so bold and often fearless and, I don't know, lives out loud or whatever cliche you want to use as aspirational or cautionary?
I think it's aspirational to people like me who tend to be more on the birdie side of things. I'm just always trying to like behave myself in reality, even though I'm kind of unleashed in my art. Yeah, I don't know. I think she just seems like she's having a good time, But then you listen to like her book, I listened to it as a book on tape, and you're like, oh my God, I can't believe like how much she's gone through in her life. And clearly she's just someone who can get by in any situation. Like, she's going to survive.
Do you write things for Tuca that are things that you would like to imagine yourself doing?
Yeah, wearing short shorts, you know.
First and foremost.
She's very comfortable in short shorts. A lot of the things Tuca does reminds me of how I was in my 20s, more like how I lived. And then Birdie's sort of more like I am now, which isn't to call Tuca immature. I don't believe that about her at all. But I think I just changed as a person.
What changed?
I used to be like more kind of, blah, like I just kind of put everything out there and I was really tactless and I lived in a messy apartment and like I, you know, didn't have my stuff together. But in some ways I was like kind of having more fun. Yeah, I don't know. I'm more careful now.
Does writing that kind of character make you think about the consequences of living in that way? Because she doesn't live without consequences.
Yeah, and we see that. She's having trouble like forming intimate relationships with anyone other than Birdie. And I think that feels pretty true to life.
To you?
Yeah. Yeah, I think if like you're kind of struggling to get by and like you're a mess and like you're used to being kind of loud and out there, that could maybe be like a defense mechanism. She's sober, so we kind of see like she gets like socially anxious in situations where in the past she might have like had a drink or five to lubricate the situation. So she's having trouble like going on dates or, you know, meeting new people.
How did you decide to make her sober?
It was just a way to kind of flesh out her character a little more and kind of deepen her. I didn't want her to just be like the wild, crazy, wacky friend who supports Birdie on her emotional arc. You know, she needed her own stuff. And I have a lot of friends now that we're in our 30s who are sober. And for a lot of them, it wasn't this like dramatic thing where they hit rock bottom and now they relapsed. And, you know, it's kind of more just like a quiet decision about how they wanted their lives to be. And I think there's something interesting about showing that and showing what those struggles are. They're a little bit like more subtle.
Let's talk about some of the things that come up as themes in your work. And generally, often they come up in Tuca and Birdie too.
Mm-hmm.
One of them is food.
Yeah.
You're now, Birdie on the show is a chef, a pastry chef,
mm-hmm.
at least beginning as she begins as an accomplished amateur pastry chef. And you are not a chef.
No, I'm a terrible cook.
Do you cook? Can you cook anything?
Yeah, I'll make something in like the Instant Pot. And, you know, there's a couple things I make, but I tend to eat the same food over and over again, like 90% of the time. So
what are the foods that you eat over and over again?
Oh, I make like chicken chili verde, or I'll make like a chicken curry in the Instant Pot, my favorite. I'll make stuff in the rice cooker. I don't know, simple egg dishes.
Do you eat like the same thing for breakfast every day?
Pretty much.
What is it?
Usually like a slice of gluten-free toast with nut butter and a banana. Sometimes eggs if I'm really feeling it.
How do you come up with all of the foods that are featured in Birdtown?
I really like thinking about the food industry, and like I wrote for Lucky Peach for a long time, so I've been on the periphery of that for a while. So I kind of like making up stuff that makes fun of food industry things. Like, I mean, the crunt, which is like a Kroller bundt cake combo, is kind of making fun of the cronut guy quite a bit. So we made up a lot of really silly pastries.
Can you tell me a few more of the pastries that you came up with? Was this like a day in the writer's room?
It was just a continual process in the writer's room of coming up with new things. Well, the
it's
same
like one giant piece of paper on one of the walls. Somebody's like, sorry, I know we're working on story right now, but I got a new baked good.
Here are some new pastries. Well, it's the same guy in the show who invents the crunt later comes up with the croont. And that's a croissant bun cake. And then by then, you know, you think he's a genius at the beginning. By then you're like, maybe this guy's kind of a hack. I don't know. And then Birdie starts to come up with stuff. So she comes up with choquettis, which are like a kind of spaghetti version of choquettes. And then she comes up with the sweet beak pastry, which is like a little bird head filled with lemon curd pastry.
There's something kind of like immediately sensual.
Yeah.
About your, like, the way that you draw everything is either slightly sexual or slightly foodie. You know what I mean? And it, so it fits so perfectly into this world that there would be these almost like fetishized weird joke foods.
Yeah. I mean, I like Miyazaki movies where the food is always looks so delicious. And I know we didn't have like even a fraction of that animation budget or time, but I just wanted to get a little bit of that feeling in there.
But also like Tuco is really keen on keeping meat in drawers.
Yeah, that's really disgusting. She treats food pretty differently from Birdie. Not quite the same respect there.
So let's talk about horses now.
Oh, gladly. Couldn't wait for you to bring it up.
So were you a horse girl as a kid?
Yeah. I started taking riding lessons when I was 8 and immediately switched from being a cat girl to a horse girl. Like, it was just immediate.
Is cat girl a type of girl?
Yeah, I was into cats. Like, really into cats. Thought I was a cat.
Oh.
And then I was like, no, I'm a horse.
How old were you when you started taking riding lessons?
8.
What was it about horses?
Don't know. It's like, I don't know, just picture like your favorite thing or like your favorite food or something and then try to explain why you like it so much. I don't know. It's like just chemical.
You have a horse now, right?
I do. I got her like 5 months ago.
Have you been a horse rider throughout your life?
I quit for 17 years.
Why is that?
I got scared. Like, I had a couple accidents and then it just became too much to me to try to keep it up during high school and college. And it's, you know, kind of expensive. And I was just like, yeah, I don't want to do this. It's too dangerous. And then Adam bought me some riding lessons for my birthday because I was thinking about it and I didn't want to commit. And then he just did it. And then I just got back into it. And that was about 5 years ago. And then with Juniper, my horse, I was like kind of during a lull in production when we were done with the writing process. We were done with most of design and it was just kind of sitting in edit bays all day. And I was feeling like a little depressed and I was like, I'm not really doing anything creative. What am I doing with my life? And then I just kind of found this Facebook ad for Juniper and I bought her.
Wait, you bought your horse from a Facebook ad?
Yeah.
Like the same way you'd buy an outboard motor?
Pretty much. It was the same as buying a car. Like we called up the trainer selling her and my riding teacher went to test ride her. And then I went for 2 test rides. I just was like, okay. And then she was just delivered.
Brought a coin to check the tires.
Yeah, I kicked her tires.
What kind of horse is your horse?
She's a fjord, which is a Norwegian
horse.
That's
a type of geography.
Yeah, they are the horses that can live in that part of the world.
I've seen a picture of it. There was a picture of you on the horse in the New York Times, which I was thrilled, thrilled to see. How often do you get to see somebody you know on a horse in the New York Times?
It was a life highlight for sure.
But your horse appears to be quite stout.
Yeah, she's very short with stumpy legs, and she's round like a yoga ball. But she's really strong.
Why did you pick that kind of horse? A weird stout horse rather than... It's an adorable horse.
She's very cute.
And I'm not a horse person, but it's an adorable horse. But why did you want a funny, stout, strong horse instead of... Like most people,
I'm funny, stout, and strong. No, I mean, part of it is that I had visited Norway a couple years ago when I went for a comics festival. They flew me out there and I went for a horse ride because I was like, oh, it's Norway. That means I get to meet this kind of horse that I've always thought was so cute. I've liked them ever since I was a little kid. So I went on a ride on one and she was just so great and strong and calm and tame. And then when I saw this Facebook ad, it was for a horse that was like identical to the one I'd ridden. So that was part of it.
What's her personality like?
She loves people. She loves attention. She has very strong opinions.
What does a horse have strong opinions about?
How fast they get to go on the way home. And which direction they want to go. But she's also very, very affectionate and she wants to be good and do a good job, which is good. So mostly we're on the same page.
It's a little strange to me. And tell me if this is strange to you, that here in Los Angeles, you can go to Burbank.
Yeah.
Which is, in most ways, the most extraordinarily normal suburb of all normal suburbs.
Yeah.
And then you're out by the Pickwick Bowl, and then there's just people riding horses around. Like, that was a way that you get from a suburban locale to suburban locale.
You can ride them in the street. You could ride them through the drive-thru. There's like light switch plates to cross the street, and they're up like 6 feet high so that you can press them from horseback. It's amazing. It's like a dream. There's people that have horses in their backyards there. It's just all zoned for it.
It's so confusing to me.
Yeah.
Lisa.
It's funny, like the whole drive to the barn, I'm constantly looking out the window like, oh, horses. And then I ride my horse, and then the whole drive back home, I'm like, oh, look, horses.
I go to there's a vintage textile show at the Pickwick there in Burbank, in the horse district of Burbank.
It's like right across from the equestrian center.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And I'll be driving there, and then there's just a horse in the street.
Yeah. It's really
like it belongs there and not on a hill.
I love how surreal it is. I really enjoy it.
It's a little bit like your show. I mean, like,
yeah.
Your show is like these animals that are weirdly in between animal world and people world.
Yeah.
To like, me, they're not just straight substitutes for people.
No, they still have their animal qualities. Yeah, I like that kind of contradiction. Like, I like that I'm like walking my horse down the street, literally in front of people's houses and front lawns, and then there's someone like walking a Labrador like on the other side of the street. It's just funny.
My wife's childhood best friend, one of her childhood best friends, is an equine therapist.
Mm.
And years ago, so she works with horses every day. And years ago, she was a horse guide of some kind and was thrown.
Oh, no.
And like came close to being killed.
Oh, no.
She fully recovered. And as I said, she still works with horses today. But I thought to myself, you know, there's people who are afraid of dogs and dogs can bite. And yeah. I love dogs.
Yeah.
But the like one or two times that I've been on a horse, and it hasn't been since I was like 13, but I was terrified.
Yeah, I get scared every time. Like, I'm going to go riding right after this, actually. And I'm scared. I'm nervous. Like, I don't know what's going to happen out there. But that's part of why I like it. It makes me feel like very brave, and I have to be calm while I'm doing it or else things will fall apart. Like, I have to kind of keep it together for her, you know? Yeah, I don't know. It's like the most therapeutic thing in a way.
It's like it seems like, from an outsider's perspective, someone who's ridden a horse twice in his life, it seems like you have to invest so much in the emotional relationship with this relatively empathetic animal.
Yeah. It's this 900-pound, sometimes 1,200-pound animal that you are taking care of. They're like a giant, frightened baby. My horse is afraid of squirrels. She's afraid of the sound of Velcro. I never can guess what she's going to be afraid of. I always think it's going to be like, oh, look, there's a, you know, crazy lady hula hooping, literally, is something I saw the other day, and I thought my horse would be afraid of, and she wasn't. But then like a tree branch, you know, crackles and she jumps like, oh, I'm going to be killed by a lion. You know, it's but in some ways, like, that's, you know, I relate to that as an anxious person. So I'm able to like kind of take care of her in those moments.
How often do you ride?
I'd say on average 4 times a week. I don't always ride her, though. Sometimes I just go and like walk her around and hang out with her.
Feed her carrots.
Yeah, I do. I feed her Altoids.
Wait, is that a thing?
Yeah, I think she likes peppermint.
Oh, right. Yeah, I've heard of that.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I guess an Altoid is a peppermint.
A curiously strong one.
Lisa, can you give me an update on Martha Stewart's pony?
Oh, Banchunch?
Yeah. Sometimes called Banchunch.
You know, she hasn't been posting about Banchunch as much. And I just kind of wonder, because she got him for her grandchildren. And I'm like, do they actually ride him? Like, what's going on with that? How's his training doing? She got him as quite a young horse. And so now he's getting to be a little older. He's probably better behaved now. But yeah, she just doesn't post about him nearly enough. So I kind of got to flesh out my Martha information with more stuff from the rest of her life and her other animals.
I mean, we're on NPR right now, Lisa.
Yeah.
And I'm not going to make presumptions about what radio station Martha Stewart listens to in her home in Connecticut or wherever. but I'm going to say maybe she listens to the classic rock station sometimes.
Maybe.
Maybe she's on Stern 101 or whatever it is on Sirius XM. But I'm going to guess that we have as close to a direct line to Martha Stewart as you're going to get.
I just would love to meet her and talk about her pony. I feel like now that I have my own pony, we've got something in common. Like, she's got a fell pony. I've got a fjord pony. Like, I just feel like we could be in the same, you know, we've got a lot in common now.
I think you could do it.
Yeah.
I think Martha.
I want to ride Ben Chunch. That would be like my dream.
Martha, let Lisa ride Ben Chunch.
I'm not even asking to ride one of the big ones because she has Frisian horses, which are huge. I just want to ride the little guy.
Let Lisa Chunch.
Hashtag let Lisa Chunch.
Yeah.
She does not have to acknowledge me in any way. She's like, she's got her own thing going on.
No, she does. Hi, I'm Jesse Thorne from NPR. Martha Stewart, hashtag let Lisa Chunch. Lisa Hanawalt, congratulations on Tuca and Birdie. It's
thank you.
So great, and I'm so happy for you, and thank you for all of your wonderful work.
Oh, thank you so much.
I just love it to death. Lisa Hanawalt, she's the best. Tuca and Birdie is streaming now on Netflix. If you haven't seen it, I really cannot recommend it highly enough. It is like nothing else on television, now or ever. It's really a blast. I also really loved her most recent book, which is called Coyote Dog Girl. Lisa co-hosts a podcast here at my company, Maximum Fun. It's called Baby Geniuses. She hosts it with the great stand-up comic Emily Heller. There, you will find much more talk about Martha Stewart's pony, Ben Chunch, and other things. But there's a lot of Ben Chunch, or Ben Chunch. She spells it differently at different times. Talk on that podcast. We've come to the end of another episode of Bullseye. Bullseye is recorded at MaximumFun.org world headquarters overlooking MacArthur Park in beautiful Los Angeles, California, where dock. There's these floating barge boat dock things got loose in the lake, kind of floated around. Some birds stood on it. At one point, somebody threw a green bag on it. When would it return to its mooring? Today, as it turns out. It returned to its mooring earlier today. But big excitement around here. The show is produced by Speaking Into Microphones. Our producer is Kevin Ferguson. He writes our MacArthur Park updates, in case you're wondering who to blame. Jesus Ambrosio is our associate producer. We get help from Casey O'Brien. Our production fellow is Jordan Cowling. To be fair, if I had written that one, it just would have been about how a family of three ducks was crossing Wilshire Boulevard the other day, and I was coming to park my car. But everybody stopped for the ducks. Make way for ducks, that's what I say. Our interstitial music is by DJW, the great Dan Wally. Thanks for sharing it with us, Dan. Dan just sent me a thumb drive full of new music, and he sent it in a greeting card with a bunch of yellow sunflowers on it, so I thought that was very sweet of him. Our theme song is called Huddle Formation. It's by the band The Go Team. Thanks to them and their label Memphis Industries for letting us use it. And before you go, there are decades of this show online, or at least almost decades, more than a decade. They're all at MaximumFun.org. If you click on Bullseye, you can page through them or search for a name you're looking for. You can also find them in your favorite podcast app or on Facebook, Twitter, and YouTube. Just search for Bullseye with Jesse Thorne. You can check in with us there, too. And I guess that's about it. Just remember, all great radio hosts have a signature sign-off.
Bullseye with Jesse Thorne is a production of MaximumFun.org and is distributed by NPR.